On Tech News Today, Google acquires two more startups, and they've formed a new partnership to compete against Amazon. Plus, the FCC provides all net neutrality comments for easy download, and the company that does background checks for the Department of Homeland Security got hacked. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, August 7th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. And by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster, easier, and cheaper. Post your job to 50-plus job boards with one click. Try ZipRecruiter with a free four-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. With me today at the TriCaster is Anthony Nielsen. And also with us today, because it's Thursday, is Elise Hugh, our co-anchor. Welcome, Elise.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
Now, you conspicuously are not, you don't have a newsroom behind you today. You don't have the NPR newsroom behind you. You are helping, you're moving some stuff out of your parents' house.
That's right.
And you told me before the show started that you made an intriguing discovery.
I made a really exciting discovery. I want you guys to check this out. It is my very first cell phone. It's a Nokia, but I souped it up back then, and I got myself a clear case so you can kind of see the inside of the phone.
Nice.
And it used to be hypercolor. It would change color when you put it in the sun, but I can't really get it to work anymore, probably because it's from 1998.
That is so cool. And it looks like you really took care of it. I think my first phone looks like it was been chewed on by a badger or something like that. But that looks really, really good. Looks almost new.
Thanks. It's because I kept changing phones so often. I was already setting my life path.
Well, that's really cool. And let us know what else you discover. Maybe your first game system or whatever. But enough about the past. Let's talk about the present. Google's YouTube unit has acquired Director, which makes a mobile video editing app. The product is currently aimed at small businesses who want to make marketing videos. Tom Cheridar is a staff writer for VentureBeat and joins us now. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going great, thanks. YouTube already offers cloud-based video editing, so why the heck would they need a mobile app version for video editing?
Money, probably. They actually surprised me. I had to hunt for their official statement on the acquisition that they want to use this to get advertisers to start making videos, presumably for ads, video ads. And you know, we saw a report a couple months ago that YouTube's profitable, but not, they're under where they should be for revenue. This could help that.
So, Tom, in the process of developing ads, aren't there usually middlemen? So either the media companies that you're buying the ads from are actually making it for you or offering packages. Does this cut out any middlemen in the process that were making money originally?
I don't know. I'm sure it will in some sense. You have some brands who think they can do it on their own now. And others, they might end up using this tool. The middleman might use it.
Now, there's a food network called Taste Made, and they have a similar app for editing videos. Is this going to be sort of one of the ways that different sites compete with each other, the ability for small businesses to create their own marketing apps very, very simply on mobile devices?
It might be. We're seeing like a lot of the big video players snap up companies like this. I don't really think anybody's established a strategy. They know that making it easier to edit videos, record videos on your phone, and push them to their platform is important. So Vimeo picked up one. I think it's called Cameo. And I think Yahoo did as well, but I'm not sure what they plan to do with it.
All right. Well, Tom Cheridar writes for VentureBeat.com. You can follow him on Twitter at tched. That's TCHED. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom Cheridar.
Thank you.
Well, at least that's not the only company Google acquired yesterday. What else did they get?
That's right, Mike. Google has also bought the artificial intelligence application Emu. What's Emu? Well, it's a messaging app that uses technology similar to Google Now or Siri, using machine learning to do what's called anticipatory computing, to predict what you need based on your previous inputs. Jason Abruzzese writes for Mashable. Jason, if I have messed up your name, correct it for us and tell us a little bit about what this acquisition offers Google.
Well, we've been kind of seeing this arms race between companies like Google, Apple, Yahoo for this kind of technology that's going to be able to not only kind of anticipate your needs or things you might ask for, but also be able to incorporate various parts of your life into their platforms. You know, basically what this tries to do is say, like, let's say you get a text message from a friend that says, hey, Thursday night dinner, are you available? Emu tries to say, you know, okay, well, we're going to figure out what that query is really asking, integrate your calendar and say, like, well, that night you have a softball game, so you might want to say, no, I can't really make it.
So it's a smart virtual personal assistant.
Exactly. And it really only operates over text, whereas Siri, you know, you have to interact with it over voice. Some people aren't so comfortable with that. What's interesting about this, and I have to admit that I had never heard of Emu before Google bought it. The more I looked at it, I said to myself, this is something that I would actually use, because I'm not a big, you know, I don't want to really be talking to my phone in the middle of a crowded subway platform. But if I can do it over text and it can just, you know, seamlessly enter my conversations, it's a little creepy, but it's also pretty useful.
Interestingly, Emu was founded in 2012 by ex-Google and Apple employee Gummy Halfsteinson. I think I'm pronouncing that right. You know, so this is kind of like taking the Google attitude about making things intelligent with super server-heavy number crunching in the background and bringing it to bear in a very consumery application. My curiosity around this is based on, how do you integrate multiple artificial intelligence platforms? For example, they have Google now. They acquired a company called DeepMind some time ago, which is a super deep artificial intelligence system. And now they have this kind of thing. Are they going to just live side by side with these disparate artificial intelligence engines that don't really join together in any way? Or are they going to try to integrate them somehow?
Simple answer is that they're going to have to integrate them. Emu itself is actually going to be shut down, which is, you know, just how most Google acquisitions have gone. But, you know, what they're really getting here is probably talent, a person who, you know, used to work for them. They know that, you know, obviously a very smart person in this field who may have developed a certain, you know, pieces of code, certain ideas that can then be integrated into probably their Google Now platform and, you know, just their broader suite of products. If you have too many of these things competing against each other, it does get very unwieldy. It starts running a little slower. It just doesn't work as well. So there will need to be a certain amount of either, you know, them tailoring this to the Google Now platform, or just really actually, you know, maybe recreating it from scratch, but, you know, already tightly integrated with their existing software.
Jason, what does this tell us about the larger AI or predictive computing race? It has been predicted that 2014 would be the big year for this. Is it panning out?
I don't know if 2014 is the big year for this. It's always tough to say what's going to be the tipping point where these things really end up being so good that people can't help not using them. But as you can see with this acquisition, and as Mike referenced, the DeepMind and Yahoo's been working with, I believe, Cornell University actually to develop similar types of functionality. This is something that, you know, we are going to hear about. And you know, at some point down the road, we're going to look back and it's going to be like that cell phone. It'll be like, remember our first AI? Oh, it was so clunky. But now it's something that, you know, is almost like seamlessly integrated into things like our text messages and our voice calls and things like that.
Coincidentally, Jason, last night I watched the movie Her, and I thought it was a great movie. I thought it was just a really great movie, and I thought they were extraordinarily visionary about depicting the future of this kind of artificial intelligence assistant. Of course, this sort of thing is likely, as some have speculated, to be integrated into Google Hangouts, which is Google's messaging app, and possibly video Hangouts, which would be cool as well. But do you think that we're going to get to the point where just messaging services will be the interface that we use instead of things like the way Google Now is presented now? Will it all be through the communication apps?
You know, that's a tough question to answer because I think people have always envisioned this future where you could talk to things. Even in the 1960s, it was, you know, the Jetsons and being able to come home and interact with your home almost as if it was, you know, a living entity. It might take a little longer than we had thought to really get to the point where everybody's comfortable doing that. And it really does seem that so far people are a little more comfortable maybe over email, over text messages, things like that, having people or having software interpret their desires. You know, it's an interesting, you know, sociological debate, you know, going forward is this vision of the future that we had in which we can interact with all of our programs just like another person, something we actually want and something that is going to be integrated into our livelihood. I know me personally, I'd much rather have it just over text, but, you know, I you know, never say never with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of surprising that how deeply integrated and important and central Gmail is to Google Now. I mean, Gmail is where Google Now gets so much of its information. It would make sense to just bring that intelligence right into the messaging app or into the email or whatever. And regarding the movie Her, which basically is about a guy who falls in love with a Siri-like assistant that's really advanced and very human-like, I just don't see anybody falling in love with Siri. She just seems like kind of a, I don't know, just kind of not all that friendly as far as I'm concerned.
There's going to have to be some impressive advances in the artificial intelligence to get to that point. But I think what Google is especially going to try to do is, and what Apple actually with their most recent software update also showed, is kind of this seamlessness between all your devices and all of the programs on this suite, so that if I start having a conversation on my phone about having dinner next Thursday, I can go to my calendar and it's already, you know, integrated that information. There can be a lot of very subtle applications of this kind of stuff in addition to, you know, something you actually interact and talk to.
You can read Jason Abruzzese at Mashable.com and you can follow him on Twitter at Jason Abruzzese. Thank you so much for joining us, Jason.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right. Just a sec. We're going to talk about how Google launched a new initiative, actually a partnership, to compete with Amazon. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is an awesome place to build a website. And, you know, if you have a professional career, and you know you do, you've got to look out for your own personal brand. You are the brand these days. Used to be in the old days, you were associated with your company. I work for IBM, but nowadays you are the brand. And if you are the brand, you need to brand yourself with a beautiful website. Now, SEO, you're looking for a job, you want to move up in your career, you want to make contacts, you want to cultivate a community around your particular profession. A Squarespace website is the place to do it. They have 25 beautiful design templates for you to start with. Start with a template, modify it to your heart's content. If you need a logo, yes, your personal brand could even have a logo. You can build your own using Squarespace's logo creator tool. Super easy to do. You don't need any design experience or talent, which is a good thing for me, to build a beautiful logo. You can also, of course, do it for your business or for specific products. Whatever you might need a logo for, Squarespace will enable you to do that. And if you make the switch and you have a blog, you can switch over to a beautiful Squarespace blog and just simply import your existing blog, all your past posts directly from WordPress, Blogger, Tumblr, and other blogging platforms. Super easy. And then once you have the blog on Squarespace, you can actually post by email. And as I said yesterday, I love that feature because it's super convenient. You're sending email, just send an email to your blog and that becomes a post. Very, very nice. And Squarespace is inexpensive. It starts at just $8 a month. And that includes a free domain name when you sign up for a year. And of course, their customer service is excellent 24/7. And they're really, really knowledgeable. So what are you waiting for? Start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT. And that'll get you 10% off. And it'll also let you show your support for Tech News Today. And we appreciate that. Well, Google is partnering with Barnes & Noble to offer same-day delivery of books, toys, and magazines. The service begins today. That's right. Right now, you can pick up the phone and get same-day delivery. The move puts the companies into direct competition with Amazon, but only in the three markets the partnership serves, Manhattan, West Los Angeles, and the San Francisco Bay Area, I guess, inevitably. Ben Fox Rubin writes for CNET, and he joins us now. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, how's it going, Mike?
It's going great, thanks. So why on earth would Google want to get even further into the delivery business? It doesn't seem like a particularly scalable business.
I think when it comes down to it, every single one of the major tech players wants to get into each other's businesses. So Google wants to get into Amazon's business, Amazon wants to get into Facebook's business. Apple wants to get into everybody else's business. This is another way for Google to really try to capture the online retail space, you know, despite the fact that there are some scale issues that you've mentioned.
Let's talk kind of about the practical impacts here. What kinds of things does Google Shopping Express currently deliver, and how much does it cost?
At the moment, Google Shopping Express just started last year, and they've partnered with Walgreens, Costco, Target, a handful of just really a small amount of different retailers. At the moment, you can get a trial membership for free for 6 months. I don't think that they've really come out and said how much a membership is supposed to be just regularly outside of that free trial membership. They're still really just testing this whole thing out. And otherwise, if you're going to be a non-member, I think it costs something like $4.99 for every shipment per store.
Now, of course, Amazon delivers more stuff in more cities, and they're a better brand when it comes to being associated with delivery and good delivery service. Why on earth would anybody go with the sort of the Barnes & Noble and Google partnership over Amazon?
I think a lot of folks, especially after what's been happening with Amazon bristling some book publishers, a lot of folks would like to see somebody else that's not Amazon be available for their books and their ebooks and online retailing. Obviously, this would be a huge win for Barnes & Noble if it were to, in fact, work out, because that is a very that has been a struggling business. But I think an alternative is something that people, my expectation is people are interested in that in the market, despite the fact that Amazon, as you had said, is very well known for doing shipments and doing them very well and having significantly more inventory than Google does. Google Shopping Express does at this point.
Yeah, Ben, I was actually going to mention Barnes & Noble and its troubles, because we've seen headline after headline about how Barnes & Noble stores are closing all over the place. So is this kind of a Hail Mary from them if they can successfully partner with Google and make this same-day shipping a reality?
I wouldn't describe it so much as a Hail Mary at this point. I think Barnes & Noble is trying to right their ship. They recently said that they were going to get rid of the Nook Media business, which was hemorrhaging money, and they want to get back to their bread and butter. They've been selling books online for years. I think that after speaking with them this morning, this is an intention for them to try to build out their customer base and try to get some of Google's customers. My impression was, I don't know if those are the same customers, but maybe some of them aren't, and maybe this gives them a chance to try to maintain some of their footprint and not close down stores in the coming years.
And of course, eBay is a third competitor in all this. I've always noticed, you know, I've been following this this world of seeing companies try to make a business out of delivering stuff in vans and trucks. Starting with Webvan, I guess that was in 1999 or 2000 or something like that, before they crashed and burned. It always seems like a great idea because they launch in the San Francisco Bay Area, or they launch in a place like New York City where everything is delivered anyway and everybody's used to deliveries. Or in this case, Los Angeles, where people, you know, the traffic is so horrible and it's so difficult to get around that a delivery service makes a ton of sense. But as soon as you get out of some of these core markets, sometimes Seattle is another one, but sometimes when you get out of these core markets and you get into the rest of the country, delivery services don't really work because people aren't in tune with it. They're used to they have their habits about how they do things. The sort of geography and so on doesn't really lend itself to getting a critical mass of people. Is this really the business people think it's going to be, the future of, you know, everything being delivered same day? Is this going to sweep the nation and the world, or is this just something that only works in a couple of markets?
More of an analytical question, and I'll try to answer it that way. My expectation would be that you're kind of dead on in that assumption, that this is probably really only going to work in metropolitan areas. I wouldn't readily assume that you would pay in a rural county $5 for somebody to drive products out to your house, and that would somehow be a profitable business. That being said, this could actually be something that works really well for a company like Barnes & Noble, which has struggled to get people into their stores. If, you know, somebody wants to buy a book and they're in the neighborhood, but they don't feel like getting up to go to their local Barnes & Noble, this could be a way of trying to capture a few more customers and at least try to get them away from Amazon, which has taken a lot of Barnes & Noble's business. So, it might not be coming to the suburbs anytime soon or ever, but it might work pretty well in metropolitan areas.
Ben Fox Rubin writes at CNET.com, and you can follow him at Ben Fox Rubin on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining us, and nice job getting the CNET logo in there. I appreciate that. That's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lest anyone forget. Thanks again. All right. Well, Elise, it looks like you've been covering the FCC for quite a while, and there's a new interesting development, isn't there?
That's right. I'm holding down my role as the Washington, D.C. issues reporter. This week, the FCC actually published a big bulk set of the public comments it received about its forthcoming rule on net neutrality. More than 1.1 million people did submit comments during that open comment filing period. That was a record for an FCC rulemaking measure. And this proposed rule would allow for internet service providers like Comcast to charge content providers like Netflix for so-called fast lanes in some cases. So we wanted to know what's in those comments. Dan X. O'Neill is our next guest. He collaborates with governments large and small to open up public data. Dan, welcome.
Hi.
So Dan, how significant is what the FCC released this week?
Significant in a couple of ways. One is just because of this matter itself, which is pretty important, net neutrality and having an open internet. And we're able to see, as you said, 1.1 million people who commented. And it's also important from a generic perspective to be able to see all the things that, Americans have to say about any given topic. The FCC has lots of open filings at this time, and all that's really important.
Do you think that people sending in comments knew that their comments would be made public? And also, what sort of information besides just the comments was released on the people who commented?
The FCC has a system called the ECFS, the Electronic Comment Filing System, and it clearly states what fields are required and what will be shown. The address is shown, is one item that's in that ECFS.
So people's email addresses were published along with this.
Well, it gets a little complicated. For anybody who made a submission through that system, the one that the FCC maintains, they don't ask for the email address. But they also, because there was such a deluge of comments on the topic, they also opened up just an email box, which was then filled with about 600,000 comments. And those have the email addresses of the user. And they published those.
So, Dan, I'm curious, as somebody who's actually done the bulk download and taken a closer look at the comments, what's in them? Can you identify any themes or threads that emerge from your analysis?
The theme is that people are very passionate about an open internet. And also that people are relatively knowledgeable about the subject. So people specifically reference possible regulatory cures, including the petition filed by the Mozilla Corporation around the Communications Act of 1934. So there's actually a lot of sophisticated commentary.
And I imagine there's some unsophisticated commentary as well. There's been some number crunching around certain specific choice words that are being used directed at the FCC in this whole matter.
Yeah, people like to swear. there have been a number of attempts to publish counts. It's interesting. Obviously, we would never say any of those words ourselves, but the seven forbidden words, which I think is interesting because, of course, it's the FCC that, that says that you can't themselves have it. You know, there's some pretty terrible words in that list. And, yeah, people have said them all.
Now, this is a just to give people some sense of the scale of this. They have put up 6 XML files for download, which together make up 1.4 gigabytes of commentary on net neutrality. Now, one last thing, Daniel, do you think this is going to have an influence? I mean, you pointed out that people are very passionate about an open internet. Is this going to sway them, or did they just do this to make people feel like they were involved?
Well, you know, the process is the process. They didn't make this up. They didn't. This isn't a brand new process. This is a very well-established process for rulemaking at the FCC. And one thing that gets kind of lost in the comment making is that there are many ways to talk to the FCC in this matter besides comments. There are ex parte filings. There are additional petitions. There are, you know, you can file a different approach. All that's in there as well. So there's sort of like the mass filing, and then there's, you know, the sort of, you know, policy making instrument that is possible in this filing. So, yeah, I think that it can make a difference.
Daniel X. O'Neill can be found at DanielXO'Neill.com. Where else? DanielXO'Neill.com. And you can also follow him on Twitter at DanXO'Neill. Thank you so much for joining us, Dan.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Well, a company that does background checks for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security says they've been hacked in what looks to them like a state-sponsored attack. The company is called IS Investigations Services, or USIS, and the attack probably involved the theft of personal information about DHS employees, according to a report in the Washington Post. This is particularly unsettling news. Elise, I would suggest that maybe it was China as the state sponsor, if in fact, because they tend to do this sort of thing. And it's a little bit bothersome that they went in and got personal information on the people who do background checks. It's sort of a gateway to the people who will be hired by the Department of Homeland Security. And, you know, it kind of makes me fear that somebody somewhere is building up a big dossier of people who can be reached in a sort of an espionage kind of case, or who are going to be tracked or hacked or whatever to get intelligence on the Department of Homeland Security. But these hacks just keep on coming, and it seems like everything is open for business when it comes to these state-sponsored attacks.
Well, when we've talked about China and Chinese espionage or cyber espionage in the past, a lot of our guests have talked about how they're actually just trying to get their hands on everything they can possibly get their hands on. So if it is the Chinese that are behind this, then it would make sense that they'd go after contractors who do this sort of work for the U.S. government. Of course, you know, those Russian hackers are very good, too. So yeah. As we saw in the headlines this week. So and there are geopolitical crises, it seems like, on every continent right now. So obviously it's a really weird time for the globe and in terms of technology espionage. So this is interesting to keep an eye on. And what I would suggest is that it seems like we can't keep up. You know, our security protocols or our data security protocols don't seem like they're keeping up fast enough for all these to sort of stop or prevent these kinds of attacks from happening.
Yeah.
And that is kind of bleak.
Yep, it is. And, you know, we talk a lot about governments and militaries being hacked and sometimes businesses being hacked. There are basically two kinds of hacking. Now, you mentioned the gang of Russian cyber attackers who went in and supposedly got together 1.2 billion email addresses and passwords and usernames and that sort of thing. But it has to be said that the financially motivated hacks have a tendency to be underreported, and the politically or military related hacks tend to be somewhat overreported or overhyped, because right, there are companies that are in the business of making sure that that information gets out there, as we reported yesterday, so that people go to those companies and use their services for finding out what was hacked and how to protect themselves and so on. But the financially motivated attacks, and it's very, very common for banks to be hacked, especially in Europe. It's a pandemic in Europe of banks being hacked, but the banks go out of their way to make sure that nobody ever finds out about it. And so those types of hacks, the kinds that come from regions like Eastern Europe and elsewhere, you don't even hear about them that much, but the ones that sort of come from the Chinese military and so on, you do hear about those because the victims have a high incentive to talk about it and get everybody to know about it. So that's something to keep in mind as you hear all of this kind of news.
Absolutely. It really speaks to the need for more updated payment systems. This has come up again and again that we are still using those ridiculous magnetic stripes on the back of our credit cards. That's something like 1960s or 1970s technology. Everywhere else in the world, including Latin America and Europe, have moved on to the chip and PIN system. That may not even be the best way to safeguard against these sorts of hackers right now, but at least it's not as archaic as what we're using now. And so the policy changes can't come soon enough.
I totally agree with that. And in just a minute, we're going to give you a lot of news follow-ups and some interesting information about a new twist on an old game. But first, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. If you hire people, if you're a hiring manager, you own a small business, you have to hire the best possible people. Why would you hire the second best or the third best when you can hire the best? The problem is that the best people are scattered all over the internet on different job boards and on social media, and that's where ZipRecruiter comes in to help you out. You can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including Craigslist, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all with a single click. All the social networks, all the major job sites can be sort of, you can cast this really wide net. So if that one person that you really, really want to hire is on a specific site, they will see your job, they will apply, and then ZipRecruiter will help you weed out the best candidates from the ones who aren't really qualified. So it's super easy for you to just go through and vet them and then interview them, hire them very fast. ZipRecruiter has been used by more than 200,000 businesses, and it's great for employers as potential candidates to learn about your new postings quickly, and you'll get the most motivated candidate. Sometimes when people, a really hot candidate, moves to a new, decides to look for a new job, they're oftentimes snapped up very, very quickly. So part of this is a race with other companies for you to get those best people. So right now, our listeners and viewers can try ZipRecruiter for a free 4-day trial. That's right. It's a free 4-day trial. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. Well, we got some email from a TNT fan named Tony Kelly talking about our story yesterday that Google is being sued in Hong Kong by tycoon Albert Yung Saosheng. Yung is mad that a Google search for his name brings up the word triad. He's been accused of being associated with the sort of Chinese mob. And this word triad comes up in the autocomplete dropdown. And he wants it removed, and he also wants some sort of redress for his pain and suffering. But TNT fan Tony Kelly wrote the following. It is worrying that the court considers the autocomplete results, which are created using algorithms based on data already online, as publications from Google itself. This is more likely to be a misunderstanding of the technology rather than anything political, as Hong Kong's judicial system is largely independent. And that's a good point. We lumped it together in a list of all the ways that the Chinese government is actually attacking American technology companies. And I think his point that he's implying here is that this is probably separate from that effort. And he goes on, he says that many in Hong Kong will probably welcome the potential Streisand effect of Yung trying to silence Google regarding his alleged ties to triad societies. The Streisand effect, by the way, is when somebody tries to muzzle information, and that attempt gets a lot of publicity, which brings it to light to a lot more people than would otherwise have heard about it. So he goes on and says he's repeatedly and aggressively tried to stop any negative press regarding the nature of his business dealings. The local entertainment industry that he dominates continues to see the decline, and people see his, again, alleged strong triad links as an open secret, although most, including myself, would not want their names attached to any accusations for fear of how his associates might respond. In other words, he might end up in a body bag. Well, that is a great email from you, Tony Kelly, and thank you for sending it in. I think it speaks for itself. I don't have any further comment on it, but I do want to get into some follow-up. We have lots of stories to follow up on here today.
That's right.
Let me go ahead and cover this one, and then you get the game one.
Oh, fine.
Okay. So, we're just going to bang through these very quickly. Now, we've covered a lot of stories about how the Chinese government's ongoing crackdown on free expression via social media. Now, China plans to force real name registrations on public accounts inside instant messaging tools like the popular WeChat app. Any Chinese citizen who wants to talk about politics will now need to get permission from the government in advance. We also told you about Google's tip that led to an arrest for possession of child pornography after the company detected the illegal content in the man's Gmail inbox. Now, the Smoking Gun website, love that site, reports that Microsoft did the same thing, leading to an arrest in Pennsylvania. So apparently everybody's doing it. Google continues its warm embrace of better internet security. The company's giving better search rankings to sites that use the HTTP secure protocol. Those are the ones that begin their URLs with the HTTPS instead of just HTTP. We also reported on the new Foursquare app. Some reports today are saying that Foursquare tracks users even when the app is closed. And one final follow-up, a new Apple patent application details a Siri for Mac desktop virtual assistant that could do everything the mobile version of Siri does and a lot more. Well, Elise, this new game coming out looks really kind of cool.
Yes, one more item of note here. Hasbro today announced a new $20 version of its Monopoly board game called My Monopoly. The game, which has its own website, enables players to customize the game with photos from Facebook, Instagram, Flickr, or Shutterfly. The site guides users on how to print their pictures onto stickers, which are then placed on the board as customized property spaces, game tokens, cards, and community chess cards. So that looks like a lot of fun. DIY yep. Monopoly.
My Monopoly is an okay name. I think Minopoly would have been more fun.
You like the portmanteau.
That's right. I love the portmanteau. Love it. Well, in other news, Apple is famous for its attention to detail, and a new feature in the new beta version of QuickTime demonstrates that obsession beautifully. A writer for App Advice noticed that when mirroring an iPhone screen running iOS 8 onto an OS 10 Yosemite screen running the new QuickTime, the application automatically shows the battery as being full and the Wi-Fi with all bars and the time as 9:41 a.m., no matter what the phone status bar actually displays. It's really kind of an interesting Apple-esque kind of thing. Now, Apple fans would see this news and say, see, they just love the perfect details. They love to be perfect. And Apple detractors would say, see, they love to lie. Everything about Apple is a big, fat lie. Anyway, it's pretty interesting.
No comment. Staying out of it.
Staying neutral. Well, today the Black Hat Security Conference in Las Vegas ends, but the DEF CON conference begins in the same city, so the security news will keep on rolling out of Las Vegas, and that is the tech news today. Now, our TNT fan of the day, this is a new segment we're adding here, our TNT fan of the day is Jacques Castleman from Middleburg, South Africa, who posted this picture on Google Plus. Now, we've been asking people to post pictures of how they watch or listen to tech news today, and there you are, Elise Hugh.
I love this one.
Yeah.
This is so cool, Jacques. Thank you.
Right there on the dashboard of his car. I hope you're not responsible, Elise, for any sort of accident or a bumper cruncher. But, please don't watch while you're driving, but just pull over and watch the whole show, and then you can go on your journey.
Well, that photo represents my first trip to South Africa. I've never been to South Africa, so now I can feel like I was there.
Now you kind of sort of have, without the expense. Well, Elise Hugh, thank you so much. Thursdays, as always, are fantastic because you are our co-anchor. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next Thursday.
That's right. Thanks so much, Mike.
All right. Take care. And good luck with all that moving. Well, how do you watch or listen to tech news today? Just take a picture of your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, Facebook using the hashtag How Do You Watch TNT, and we'll find it. And you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, so many options. Choose your favorite at twit.tv/TNT. Follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. That's all together with no spaces. And please send us your thoughts and opinions. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or leave voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.